Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Happy Friday, everybody. We will, on the show today, be talking about the 2022 Utah legislative session, which has gotten underway. Many lawmakers on the Hill, though, are ignoring the recommendations of public health orders and going unmasked. Senate President Stuart Adams started the session by presiding over his chamber maskless after twice testing positive for COVID-19. And speaking of going maskless, lawmakers are prioritizing doing away with public health orders aimed at protecting residents. And then tearing our eyes away from the session, the would-be dredgers of Utah Lake sue a Brigham Young University scientist who is critical of their plan. Joining me for this conversation all via the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Hello, Brian. He's on mute there. We will welcome our other guests here as well. Hey Brian.
Let me unmute, dude. Hi, Roger. It's nice to be back with your show.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. Government reporter Bethany Rogers is with us as well. And good morning to you, Bethany.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi there, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Roger. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can we invite you to join this show with your questions and comments, and you can tweet them to @KCPW, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Well, the legislature has begun, and right out of the gates, lawmakers, that is to say Republican lawmakers, took aim at orders issued by public health officials. Bethany Rogers, can you just give us the kind of rundown of what they're seeking to do on those public health orders and, how far they've gotten to date in trying to basically undo them?
Yeah, well, essentially, they're trying to end them. Pretty straightforward. They gave themselves power to overturn local health orders last year. There was the endgame bill that took away the statewide mask order and set criteria for ending local mask orders. And then they also, stipulated that for any future orders, that if it was a local order, a county council could overturn it. And then even if the county council upheld it, that the state legislature would have the ability to terminate it. So that's what they're hoping to do now. Hmm. All they really have to do in order to terminate these orders is to pass a resolution. So they have a resolution moving through the legislature right now. It has already passed through the Senate, the state Senate, which approved it on the very first day of session. Hmm. And it's over in the House right now, and we're hearing that they hope to vote it through the House today. The order would terminate mask orders in Summit County. It would terminate the 30-day mask order in Salt Lake County, which has been upheld by the Salt Lake County Council, as well as the school mask order imposed by Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall.
These are orders that are issued by public health officials, people who study infectious diseases and how they spread, and also the implications for residents. And there are also orders upheld by the county councils, as you said, and the legislature has the option there of overturning them, gave themselves that option. Is it maybe worth reminding people why many lawmakers are so distraught by people being required to wear masks, Bethany? What is their major concern here?
They've brought up a number of different, frustrations as they've, moved this resolution forward. One thing that they've said a lot is, they're hearing from constituents across the state who don't like masks. As we know, there's this vocal group of anti-maskers, really from across Utah, that's been targeting local mask orders. So even people from outside of Salt Lake County coming in and objecting to Salt Lake County's mask mandate. They have their doubts about the effectiveness of masks against the Omicron variant, which is in conflict with what we've been hearing from medical experts. But you had Senator Dan McKay, who is the sponsor of this resolution, speaking maskless in the Senate floor and saying, he really doesn't think that that masks are very effective in containing the spread of the disease.
I was going to say that idea that it doesn't help prevent the spread of diseases, including coronavirus, that's just not true, right?
Yeah, what we've been hearing from medical experts is that, you know, there are types of masks that are more effective than others, but it's a question of good, better, best, and not effective versus ineffective. So, you know, Governor Spencer Cox made some similar comments about a week ago, you know, saying he doesn't think that masks are very effective in preventing a variant as infectious as Omicron. And in response, you know, Dr. Andy Pavia, who is one of the top infectious disease doctors with Intermountain, came out and said that those statements are misleading and that, you know, if possible, you should get your hands on an N95 mask, a KN95 mask, but that even a cloth mask would be better than nothing. So that concern is not supported by the medical experts. The other thing that the lawmakers are saying, which kind of echoes what you also hear from these anti-maskers, is that you know, they feel that government-imposed mandates are unnecessary, that Utahns will do the right thing regardless of a government mandate, and that the mandates are an infringement on personal liberties.
Okay. And meanwhile, of course, you know, we're seeing hospitalizations at record high, though I guess ICU utilization is actually down, which is a good thing. But health officials say now is not the time to be letting down our guard, or for leaders or public, you know, officials, I guess, to be sending the wrong message to people who are to residents of the state. And that's exactly what you just described with Dr. Pavia and others saying this is not the time to let up. It's not a done deal. As you pointed out, this resolution by Senator McKay, which passed the Senate on day one, does it have a tougher road in the House of Representatives? In one of your articles, it seemed like maybe they might, because of some political considerations, not be as apt, I guess, or as likely to pass this resolution.
Yeah, my colleague Brian Shaw has been reporting that some of the Salt Lake County Republicans were a little bit concerned about getting on board with this mask overturn effort. But, you know, that they are nearing the end of their debate on the issue, and that, you know, it's expected to come up for a vote, as I said today. You know, so it definitely seems like it's had a bit of more of an uphill climb in the House versus the Senate, but it seems that we're kind of nearing an end to that.
All right. I'd like to bring in the news columnist, Robert Gerke. And Robert, I want to get your take as an opinion columnist on, you know, what we've touched on so far, and also on something else that you wrote about this week, the fact that the president of the Senate was still testing positive for coronavirus even as the session was getting started. But let's start. Maybe we can start there, actually, Robert. I think that to some extent, I only have the headline version, which is that the Senate President Stuart Adams was maybe still contagious, but told people otherwise.
I mean, that's sort of it in a nutshell. He started getting sick last Wednesday, and Thursday tested positive for COVID, canceled his events Thursday and Friday. Under the CDC guidelines, you're supposed to quarantine, isolate for 5 days, which would have put his fifth day from Wednesday on the Tuesday of the opening of the session. So he shows up Tuesday morning, takes a COVID test, it comes back positive. So he takes another one, and it comes back and it has a faint line on it. The chief of staff says he thought that was a negative, but the directions on the tests are pretty clear that if there's any line there at all, it's a positive. Nonetheless, he, you know, goes out and convenes the session, is on the dais without a mask on after testing positive twice, and tells the body and tells the public that he tested negative twice. He initially said he tested positive, then he said, oh, no, I mean, I tested negative. You know, I want everybody to know I was negative twice. And it wasn't true. You know, so he, you know, presided maskless throughout the day, both in the morning session and in the afternoon session. You know, people at the Capitol and around the Capitol talk, and so we heard that, you know, he had in fact tested positive. So we put in a grandma request and asked for clarification from his staff, and they backtracked and said, well, no, he, you know, he had these two positive tests. He thought one was negative, but he had two positive tests. So it was just a reversal. And I think it kind of goes to the overarching mentality that we're seeing at the legislative session, where you've got these people who just want to will it away and pretend it doesn't exist. People like Dan McKay, who think that if they pass a law that, you know, that it doesn't matter, that it won't matter anymore. And, you know, and you mentioned that we've got almost 760 people in the hospital right now. Our previous high was about 620. So we're, you know, 25% higher than our previous high in hospitalizations. And, you know, our ICU utilization is still way up. It's like 93% right now. They're doing a really good job of managing it, but it's, you know, we're teetering there, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yesterday, I know that Sandy Democratic Representative Suzanne Harrison, who is a doctor, said that there have been times when she's felt more worried about getting the virus up at the Capitol than, you know, at the hospital while she's treating COVID-19 patients, because of the fact that there is so much unmasked activity happening. And that's something that is allowed, I guess, because the governor exempted state facilities from the county mask mandate. Although, of course, as Bethany pointed out, lawmakers are working to undo that anyway. How about, Robert, do you want to return to the topic of those health orders being challenged in general, what lawmakers are doing?
And just to what Representative Harrison said, she should be concerned, I think. We've heard Senator Kitchen said that there is word, you know, this hasn't been confirmed, and the House and Senate are stonewalling us on any data about test representatives and senators who tested positive. But Senator Kitchen said that two representatives tested positive and went about their business as normal without a mask on. And it's just, you know, and then you add that to Senator Adams, and it's troubling. The governor had exempted all state facilities through an executive order from any county or city mask mandate or requirement. So, you know, you've got your liquor stores and also like DMV offices and the Capitol that they say are exempt from these. They are also, I believe, there's a rule or a resolution to clarify that the Capitol Hill complex is exempt. And you go up there and you know, most of the people are not wearing masks. I mean, I think, and it's particularly stark, the distinction is particularly stark when you go into the chambers and see the senators and the representatives on the Republican side of the aisle, almost none of whom are wearing masks. And you know, it's going to spread up there.
And
going to the point about rescinding these mask requirements, you know, as we talked about Dan McKay's bill, I think that, you know, my understanding is that they were trying to coerce the county council into rescinding that on their own, to holding another vote. And the representatives or the council members refused to do it. So I think the House will proceed and go ahead and do it. You know, it's the important factor to keep in mind is whether you think masks work a little. Excuse me, I probably have COVID this morning.
No.
If you think masks work a little or masks work a lot, it's the only thing that anyone in the state is doing to try to control the spread of the virus. And so that takes away the only tool in the toolbox right now for controlling this virus. And I think, you know, given what we've seen, we talked about it last week, Omicron is going to be short-lived, but it's going to be very severe in terms of the number of infections, which translates into number of hospitalizations, and we're seeing that already, and it's going to translate into deaths.
If voluntary mask wearing, you know, if that was the norm, people would be a lot more protected, and, you know, but it's not the norm, and as you can see at the Capitol, and so local leaders instituted these mask orders, and I'm wondering, I guess it's sort of a contradiction, the idea that you're undoing the mask orders because you don't want to force people to do something. You want them to act of their own accord to do what's right for their community. But in the end, you know, you're not doing that yourself. It's a contradiction. And I want to talk about the whole of the session as well and bring Bethany back in, Robert, unless you've got a final point there on...
I was just going to note that it's just one of many things they're doing. They also took away the test to stay program. They're looking at taking away the rights of businesses to require vaccinations, on and on and on. They're doing everything they can to take away any precautions or safeguards that are in place, just dismantle the entire effort to combat the virus. And so we're done basically as a state in trying to control the virus. It's now just we're going to let it roam free.
Hmm. Bethany Rogers, let's bring you back into the conversation where I guess we're throwing up, you know, the surrender flag on coronavirus. I do want to zoom out a little bit and talk about what else we can expect from this session. Robert, I'll come back to you and pose the same question. But Bethany, aside from, you know, masks and undoing those orders put in place by health experts, what do we have a sense of what the other big priorities of lawmakers for the next 42 days, 42? Yeah, I think 42 days are.
There's going to be an effort to cut taxes. That's something that, the Utah legislative leaders get asked about COVID, but what they want to talk about is a tax cut. So it certainly seems to be, a big priority of theirs to slash, we believe, the income tax rate. That's the one that they seem to have their eye on. The governor has wanted to get rid of or provide a grocery tax credit for low to middle income Utahns and sort of provide that the funding that lawmakers have set aside as a targeted tax cut. But Utah legislators have set aside $160 million and they say they really want to focus on bringing down income tax rates. So that's one thing we can expect out of the legislative session. Another thing, is action on water shortages. We've seen that, there are bills that, aim to incentivize people in, water conservation and to prevent municipalities from requiring, grass and landscaping that requires water. So that's going to be another priority. And we're also going to see, some of the culture war issues come back again. We know that, the state lawmakers last year vowed to pass bills that relate to critical race theory. That was a debate last year, and they really kind of punted that issue and said, we'll do something about that in the next general session. So we're expecting to see them address that in some form, as well as, there's a bill that Representative Kara Berkland has sponsored that deals with transgender sports, which is something that she brought forward last session and didn't go anywhere. Right. She has a revised version of her bill that she's expecting to introduce, and also another bill that deals with transgender healthcare for children that we're expecting to see, as well as another attempt to abolish the death penalty in Utah. It's not clear how much momentum that has this year, but that is going to be something that that lawmakers debate.
That's a solid list of legislative preview there. Thank you very much, Bethany, for that. And Robert Kirky, I'll just ask you the same question. Any big sort of themes that you're paying attention to at this session?
I think Bethany summarized them well. I mean, I think the tax debate's going to be interesting, and I'm curious to see how that one ends up. Obviously the COVID stuff, and I think the election law stuff. The governor mentioned last night in his state of the state, I know we're going to go into that more, but he mentioned last night in his state of the state that, yeah, he's not inclined to see people try to undo some of the things Utah's done in the state to improve our election system.
Yeah.
I think those are sort of the big topics I'm keeping an eye on. And then the death penalty repeal this week, Brian Stevenson, the author of Just Mercy, which you may have seen the movie, but you should read the book as well, was in town advocating for the repeal of the death penalty. And it's got more traction than I maybe would have thought and than we've ever seen in the past. So those are going to be some big issues.
All right. One of those I want to come back to after the break, and that is, as you said, the State of the State address by Governor Spencer Cox. This is Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll come back in just a minute. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Bethany Rogers, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. I want to squeeze in, as I said, one more story from Utah's capital and talk about last night's State of the State address by Utah Governor Spencer Cox, if only briefly. It was a pretty brief speech, actually, that he gave. And Bethany Rogers, you covered it. There were a number of items that he talked about as priorities, increasing education funding, for example, dealing with the state's water future. I want to zero in on those a couple of items that he said that Robert mentioned relating to election, you know, conspiracy theories and American divisions. And actually, I've got a couple of clips here from last night's speech by Utah Governor Spencer Cox. Take a quick listen and then we'll come back.
Unfortunately, some in our country have found that unsubstantiated claims and flat-out lies are an effective way to destabilize our constitutional republic and make it harder for their opponents to participate and vote. Voting security must never be about making it harder for legal voters to vote. Please beware of false choices. As a conservative, I believe that we should always work to make constitutional rights more accessible, not less. I am very proud that voter participation has increased since I became Lieutenant Governor and now Governor. We can have safe and secure elections without making it harder to exercise our constitutional right to vote. As I've traveled the state, I've heard some feel that the Constitution is in danger. Some argue that the Constitution will someday, if not now, hang by a thread and need rescuing. I worry that what a few of them fail to see is that they, just like those for whom they have so much disdain and contempt, are daily hacking away at those cords, recklessly believing that they will know exactly when to stop slicing and start saving. It used to be said that all politics is local. I no longer believe that to be true. Today, all politics is national. And that is bad, very bad. The easiest thing in the world is to watch MSNBC or Fox News and simply adopt all of their talking points and policies. It's certainly more entertaining than this speech. It's the most tried and true way to get likes on social media. It's also terribly destructive. And it certainly isn't leadership. But that's not us. That's not Utah. At least it's not Utah at its best.
Bethany, I sort of stole your reporting by playing those clips, and so maybe I will actually just immediately turn to Robert Gerke, the news columnist, on this. And I guess, Robert, the question that I have here is, you know, those aren't exactly popular positions in the governor's party, at least the statement on election security. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I think the thing that I took from the speech was that, you know, he kind of positioned himself as the guy in the middle, the oppositional force to a lot of these things, the corrosiveness of social media, the partisanship, the election fraud claims. And he's the guy who's going to be the oppositional force to those. So, you know, I think all in all, it was a clever rhetorical tactic. We'll see if he follows through on any of this. But yeah, I mean, the election law stuff really kind of jumped out just because, you know, he and Lieutenant Governor Henderson have both been pretty outspoken on their feelings on the election law, election fraud claims, that they think that they're meritless and that they don't want to see anybody undo the election progress that we've made. So I think he sent a pretty clear message in that respect on COVID. You know, obviously he tried to position himself as the guy in the middle who thinks that we, you know, that it's been too politicized, and you know, in other instances also kind of positioned himself as the anti-politics politician, I guess. Yeah. You know, so I think the message was solid. I think we've got to wait and see how he acts on these particular issues.
Well, I guess the question that I have is, are there, you know, renewed pushes at the legislature during this session that we know of yet to try and get more accounting or you know, sort of There was legislative audits, yeah. I guess, of audits of elections were suggested in the past, and I think something passed on that front.
They're conducting the audit as we speak, and we anticipate that there will be efforts to perhaps strengthen voter ID, get rid of ranked choice voting, and then of course there's the ballot initiative that would get rid of early voting, or you know, get rid of almost all early voting. So, and Bethany, do you know of any others that I'm missing?
No, I don't know of any others.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's we anticipate there might be more. So,
sure.
We've seen it in other states, and you know, it's worth noting, as the governor mentioned, all politics is national. It's all been nationalized. So we've seen these efforts to restrict voting in other states. Logic would indicate that we would anticipate seeing them here this session.
The comment I played that second clip on, you know, where you talked about MSNBC and Fox News, that I don't know if most of America, you know, watches either of those outlets as much as we talk about it. I think it's something like 3% and 6% of the country, respectively. I might be wrong about that, and I'll have to verify. But, you know, I think that I would point more directly to social media, especially Facebook, for how inane information gets spread around. My little rant there, and Gricky, you could add to my rant if you want to, or you know, you could talk about the power of the legislature. You wrote a column this week, an eye-opening column, I'll say, about the unchecked power of the legislature, and you say that they are more powerful than ever, and definitely more powerful than the governor is. This is down to the powers that they have granted themselves, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that kind of goes to what we were talking about, Governor Cox being the oppositional force. He really is the only person who can be a check on the legislature. And we've seen over the last several decades that governors have been loath to do that. You know, Governor Leavitt was a little bit stronger than Governor Walker. But, you know, ever since Governor Huntsman, the veto power has rarely been used, about, you know, a lot less. They're using it a lot less often than their predecessors. The legislature itself has become more professional. They meet longer. They do interim sessions. Their staff has increased over the decades, both in quality and quantity. And that kind of gives them a power in relationship to the governor. And they've removed the checks that are normally in place. The Democrats obviously have not been a meaningful check on the Republican legislature for some time. The governors, as I mentioned, have not been willing to do it. And we've also seen them change the structure. And the most notably, I think, is the constitutional amendment that they passed that allows themselves to call themselves into session rather than having to negotiate those special sessions with the governor. It makes them, you know, as we've seen in the past year, 2 years now with COVID, it gives them a tremendous amount of power to call themselves into session, pass whatever bills they want to pass, with very little, you know, very few guide rails on the extent of that power. So, you know, we're seeing it play out this session. Yeah, we're seeing it on the COVID front, but we're going to see it elsewhere, where they just have this almost unchecked power. And again, the only check that seems to be there is the governor, if he chooses to use that power and engage with the legislature in that way.
I guess both in terms of the kind of rhetorical devices that he can use or rallying people, but then he also has the power of veto, though, as you said, the legislature can call themselves into session and override his vetoes, because they have this, I mean, they basically control everything and have consolidated power.
And the leaders, just to, before we move on, the leadership has gotten much stronger. They have a consolidated caucus that's sort of much more like-minded than in the past. They have these closed caucus meetings where they can whip people into shape, and so, you know, they have just sort of created they've become a behemoth. So,
well, power and who wields it and to what ends. I encourage people to read Robert's column. It has comments from former Governor Gary Herbert, political scientists, lawmakers, and even veteran political reporter Rod Decker makes an appearance in Robert's column. So check that out over at sltrib.com. And a reminder that you're listening to Behind the Headlines. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet them to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter with the Tribune. We've kept you under wraps this whole time. I want to turn now to some follow-up reporting that you've been doing, to some reporting that you've done before about the proposal to dredge Utah Lake to supposedly clean it up. while also making these islands, which would get new real estate developments on them. It's a plan that has its critics, and among those critics is a BYU University scientist and professor, Ben Abbott. And, you know, the would-be dredgers of the lake are taking exception to his criticism, and in fact, they are suing him. Tell us about this. Why are they suing Dr. Abbott?
Yeah, so, hey, can you hear me, Robert?
Yes, indeed, we can hear you.
I'm sorry, Roger.
Yeah
so Ben Abbott is among, a professor of ecology at BYU, is among several academic scientists who've, you know, raised a lot of reservations about this proposal by a company called Lake Restoration Solutions.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, what they want to do is, you know, dredge about a billion cubic yards of sediments off the lake bed, deepening it by 3 to 5 feet. Not a whole lot, but it still would make the lake substantially deeper than it is now. And then create 20,000 acres, give or take, of artificial islands, and approximately half of that would then be, you know, given over to this company for real estate development. The rest would be used for public recreation or wildlife habitat. So what Abbott has claimed, you know, with a lot of backing from the scientific community, that deepening the lake in this manner and building these islands, A, might not be technically feasible, so it would be so massive, but also could really disrupt the natural ecology of the lake and do more harm than good. But that's not what he's being sued over. It's basically he's made many, you know, kind of factual claims in his public appearances and social media and on his blog and regarding, you know, the financing of this project, the extent that the lake bed of Utah Lake would be privatized, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Has, according to the company, not been accurate. And they're claiming that it amounts to defamation as part of a deliberate effort to turn the public against this project. The project does have the backing of the Utah legislature and is under review, or soon to be under review, by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So that's kind of in a nutshell what this is about. And a lot of Professor Abbott's allies in this have denounced the suit as what's known as a SLAPP lawsuit, which is a acronym for the type of lawsuit aimed at quelling public participation in an environmental issue. Actually out raising money to kind of put together a counter lawsuit against this company.
The SLAPP lawsuits are called our strategic lawsuit. Lawsuits against public participation is the idea there.
And, oh, thanks,
and
Roger.
You're welcome. I had to look it up. You know, there's, I guess, one of the claims that one of the things that Ben Abbott has said from BYU about this project is that we don't have an idea of the kind of scientific foundation that dredging the lake will fix the lake. And I guess we don't have that because the company hasn't really disclosed what the scientists they're relying on or their funding sources, right?
Yeah, I think that's the core question here, is what is the scientific basis for this company's claims that dredging the lake and building islands is going to fix it? Everybody agrees that Utah Lake, which is the biggest freshwater body in the state of Utah and around in the West, that for that matter, is one of the top three. It's in a lot of trouble ecologically. It's been contaminated with effluents from ag and wastewater, and these nutrients have settled into the lake bed, and they get stirred up, and it promotes algal blooms, and then there's invasive fish and plants, and it is a mess. So everybody agrees. And there's millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent currently on various restoration efforts. So anyway, the core issue here is, well, what is the scientific basis for this idea that dredging the lake will help? You know, history is full of examples where dredging, especially in the freshwater environments, has been an ecological disaster. And, you know, we can look to Lake Tahoe, as a antecedent for this, where they dredged out the Truckee River Provo, the Truckee River Delta into the south end of the lake to build a real estate development. It really wrecked the ecology of the lake, and it's been 50 years of trying to fix. So part of the problem is the company hasn't made its science available to the public yet. So in a sense, Abbott and others are just kind of like, okay, well, we don't think there is a scientific basis. They don't have any scientists on their design team and it turns out that might not really be true. We just don't know who Lake Restoration Solutions scientists are yet. They have said that they would make this information available once the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers begins its formal review of the project under the National Environmental Policy Act, and that ought to be in the next month or so.
I'm wondering, is there further action that the legislature might take in terms of funding? I know that you said they endorsed the project, but in terms of funding streams, and then also just in general, the cost of the project and where the money might be coming from.
Yeah, well, that's a big question. The company hasn't publicly divulged who their funders are, but they say they have $6 billion plus of commitments from various entities. It's all going to be private money. However, they have they are seeking $1 billion, maybe $900 million of loan guarantees from the Environmental Protection Agency to support this project. They're on a wait list for that, for consideration for that money. And they've also sought, or been, at least the legislature has directed the Governor's Office of Economic Development to extend $10 million in loan guarantees for this project. So there is public money that's being sought to support this project.
Can I also ask just the time frame, Brian? I mean, we've talked about this before on the show, but until things start happening, I don't think I understand exactly how long it would take to dredge Utah Lake, to build islands, to then build houses on those islands, et cetera. What are we talking about here?
Yeah. So the COO of the company, John Benson, last week at the Utah Lake Summit, did offer some new fresh details there, and it would take the permitting process would take 18 to 24 months from starting today. And the project itself would unfold in five phases over 15 years. And the first phase would be islands, developed off of Vineyard, this fast growing town on the northeast shore of the lake. So we now have a sense of how this thing would unfold. He also said the project's been scaled back somewhat. It was originally for 20,000 acres of islands, which would cover about a fifth of the lake, but it's down to now about 18,000 acres. Still a lot of land being created there. And about 9,000 of that will be, then used for commercial and residential real estate development.
But I mean, decades in the future, a decade in the future. I think you said this at the very beginning.
Well, he said 15 years once the project is started.
Okay.
Dredging a billion cubic yards of material off the lake bed will take. Having multiple dredgers going 24/7 would still take 10, 15 years easily to move that amount of material. This may very well be one of the largest dredging operations ever attempted, at least in freshwater.
Let's bring in Robert Gerke, the news columnist, on this. I guess we should start by asking you about the lawsuit that the proponents, or that the backers, the people behind this project to dredge Utah Lake, are launching against this Brigham Young University professor, Ben Abbott. And then, if you want to talk about we've talked about this before, sure. But if you want to talk about the project in general, you can do that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, it is a slap lawsuit that's trying to quiet opposition to the project. You know, rather than combating, you know, what they think is misinformation with the facts, they go to the courts and try to silence, you know, any opposing voice. I think it probably speaks a lot to the tactics we're likely to see from this group and sort of the bare knuckle approach they're going to take. It's, you know, in terms of the viability of the project, I think, you know, I would defer to the experts on this, the people who study the lake and so forth. And they've raised some concerns about it. A lot of questions have not been answered in any meaningful way. The transparency on their financing, I think, is the lack of transparency on the financing is troubling. And, you know, Brian, if you want to talk about the story we're going to be posting this morning, they seem to be trying to make an end run around local authority. In my mind, I mean, they will insist that's not the case. But Brian, why don't you discuss that?
Yeah. Later today, Robert and I are posting a story about proposed legislation that will be introduced soon to create something called the Utah Lake Authority, which will take management of the lake bed, which is public property, it's state sovereign lands, and put it under the jurisdiction of a new agency called the Utah Lake Authority. Which would have, you know, a lot of power to decide what will happen to the lake. And the sponsor of this bill, is Brady Brammer of Utah County, a Republican. He brought this bill forward last year, and there was just so much opposition to it that he withdrew it and has spent the last year reworking it. And a revision of the bill kind of turned up in Robert's email inbox not too long ago. And so we're going to do a story about it, explaining how this bill is it's going to be coming forward. It's been revised to address some of these objections that were raised last year. And the main thing, according to Brammer, is it will in no way could it be used to advance the island building dredging proposal. That project is, you know, being controlled by a bill that was passed 4 years ago, HB 272.
4 years.
That, you know, yeah. I hope I'm getting the number right. But that's the bill that the legislature passed to, you know, basically instruct the Department of Natural Resources to consider this project and make a decision. So that decision-making authority will still remain with the Department of Natural Resources and the Legislative Management Committee. This new entity will then be, tasked with developing, you know, future proposals to develop and fix the lake. So there's still going to be a lot of concerns about this bill, but it seems like Brady Brammer has really revised it to allay a lot of these other concerns.
Can I?
Think of this Utah Lake Authority as the Inland Port Authority for Utah Lake.
What is an authority? What can you give us? You know, you've got the Inland Port Authority, you've got the Point of the Mountain Authority. There's another authority here. What does it mean?
Yeah, Robert.
Oh, they're just creating an entity with an appointed board to make decisions regarding land regarding the use of the lake, and that includes restoration, but it would also include presumably the Utah Lake project, which they're pitching as a restoration effort, and they can issue bonds, they'll collect part of the taxes the tax increment still being worked out, but they'll be collecting taxes to pay the bonds. And so they'll be making decisions regarding the lake rather than, you know, and the concern last year when Representative Brammer proposed this was that local governments didn't like it because they felt like they were losing some of their say in the process.
Wow. And so that's going to be unveiled at this session, and we will see. I mean, I guess, do we know anything about support, you know, how much support there is at the legislature for a new authority like this?
I mean, I think it's maybe a little premature to say, but I think, you know, I think with the amount of work that Representative Brown has put into it, I would imagine that he's been lining up support for it. There have been a number of senators and representatives who've been involved or at least aware of the process. So, you know, I suspect once we see it, it's likely to get some favorable consideration.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
no, Brian, go ahead.
Roger. Yeah. Brady Brammer has been talking about this bill all summer at ball interim sessions at various, you know, Utah Lake events where the issues of the lake are discussed. So the, you know, this bill is no surprise, but it's, you know, finally it's out there for public consumption. And that's significant. And I think the thing I want to draw attention to one provision in it where he basically explicitly says that the proposed Utah Lake Authority will have no power to, you know, dispose of quote unquote public land.
Okay.
As part of this, so that one provision
has ameliorated some fears that people had, I guess.
That's the main piece, I think.
I don't mean to cut you off there, Brian, but we do need to head to another break in the show, and so I will just direct people to the forthcoming reporting that you and Robert are going to publish today. Otherwise, I'll just say you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thank you for your reporting on this, by the way. And this is from KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back with our underplayed stories of the week in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup. And right now, just because we're up against the end of the hour, I'm going to turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Bethany Rogers, we haven't heard from you in just a little bit, so maybe I'll bring you back into the show and ask you for your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you're ready.
Well, I just want to give a plug to our new podcast called The Daily Buzz. It's going to go up 5 times a week, and it's going to be short little bite-sized segments that basically overview the day's news and sometimes have a little interview, keeping it under 10 minutes. So go check it out.
You can subscribe to that at sltrib.com. I have done that myself. Robert Gerke, let's go to you. A pick for underplayed story of the week.
I think I'll plug a story that Courtney Tanner did, that the federal government is now looking into how BYU's Honor Code Office has handled issues involving LGBTQ students. You know, it's kind of, we've talked about it on the show before, some of the issues that have arisen with, you have a private religious university trying to handle these, and now the feds are interested in these issues as well. So check it out.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and the fact that there's an investigation going on. I found that reporting really interesting. Check that out at sltrib.com by Courtney Tanner. Brian Maffley, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I just subscribed to the Daily Buzz. So, Robert just stole mine. The BYU story, I think, is a really big deal. But I'm going to just draw attention to the passing of Rick Reese, an outdoor educator and conservationist who's from Utah, but has lived in Montana for many years. But he died last week at the age of 79 or 80. And he has had a profound impact on the environmental community in Utah and the outdoor community. He was a brilliant climber, a close friend of Ted Wilson's.
Yeah, former mayor of Salt Lake City. And was responsible, I think, for or in many ways responsible for the building of the Bonneville Shoreline Trail, right?
Yeah, at least the establishment of the idea. Exactly. Yeah, he played an important role there.
That's a great pick for underplayed story from Brian Maffley. Thank you for that. I, for my part, am going to go with a story that published this morning by Aaron Alberti that is about how hospitalizations among Utah infants and children with COVID-19's Omicron strain are up quite a bit. And for kids under five, the Omicron variant appears to not be so mild according to one pediatric expert that that Aaron Alberti spoke with. And so check out that story. It's troubling, but it's important reporting and great reporting. You can find it over at sltrib.com, like everything else that we've been talking about on the show today. And with that, I will say Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter, Bethany Rogers, government reporter, and Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank
you, Roger.
Me.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Raj. See you later, Beth. Bye-bye.
See you later. Yep. And that does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts over at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And that does it again. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week. And join the show with your questions and comments whenever you like.